DC Public Library Podcast is made possible in part by the Institute of Museum and Library Services and is a production of the labs at DC Public Library.
You're tuned into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am your host, Olubunmi Bakari. This is our All Things Local series where we highlight the local history, culture, communities, and personages who have made an impact on Washington, D.C. My guest today is Natalie Hopkinson. Natalie is a former staff writer, editor, and culture critic for the Washington Post and The Root. Natalie is currently an assistant professor in Howard University's graduate program in Communication, Culture, and Media Studies, and a fellow at the Interactivity Foundation. She is the author of Deconstructing Tyrone, Go Go Live, and A Mouth Is Always Muzzled, which is her current book. Her commentary and writing have appeared in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, TheAtlantic.com, NPR, Essence Magazine, and the BBC, just to name a few. Jeez, woo! In honor of Go-Go Month at the DC Public Library, Natalie joins me to discuss her work, Go-Go Live, The Musical Life and Death of a Chocolate City. Natalie, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Go-Go for me, you know, I'm a native Washingtonian. I grew up listening to Go-Go. It was like the soundtrack of my childhood and my teenage years. I grew up in Northeast D.C. Max Kidd lived in my cul-de-sac, so he was like Uncle Max to me. I grew up with his younger daughters. So I remember being in his house, you know, I was a child, so I don't know who these people were, but he had a recording studio in the basement, different musicians in and out, pictures all on the wall. Like, the coolest picture that I always looked at when I went in there was a picture with Michael Jackson, and it was the Thriller Michael Jackson. But anyway, yeah, so I went to Go-Go's, you know, it's teenagers. I went to different venues. Where I grew up, it was Dino's was down the street. It was called Breezy's Metro Club, which you mentioned in the book, was down the street. I went to the Zulu Cave, the Ice Box, as it was called at the time, the Black Hole. There were concerts at Stadium Armory, featured numerous go-go acts that you mentioned in the book, Go-Go Live. So when I picked up the book, you know, I was like, oh, Go-Go Live. It's a book about live go-go music. But as I began to read, it's about live go-go music. But there's also, how would you describe it? How would you describe this book?
Yeah, so it is about go-go. So Go-Go Live is, of course, taken by the famous live go-go recording classic, go-go recording, and so I took that for the topic of the book. But the subtitle actually tells a little bit more. It's The Musical Life and Death of a Chocolate City. And so basically it's sort of a social history of Black Washington, and go-go is the lens to look at it. So it's a way of understanding Black Washington, you know, and people who, like you, grew up with Go-Go as a soundtrack. You know, Go-Go is sort of it's the heartbeat of the city, and it's the best way to explain. So it's a metaphor for the Chocolate City, and I think can speak to a lot of chocolate cities around the country as well, although, you know, there's only one, you know, original Chocolate City, which is D.C.
So in your opinion, how would you describe Go-Go music to someone who doesn't know what it is?
So usually I talk about go-go as a sort of a version of funk that has a lot of percussion, many layers of percussion, the conga drums, is that's how you know that it's go-go, is the conga drums and the beat, capital T, capital B. There's also many layers of horn sections, and so it's just, it's a sort of a wide, big, full sound. But go-go is more of an experience than a musical genre. Like, a musical genre just feels small. You know, go-go is much more than that. And so that's why I tried to capture in the book. I mean, it's a history. It's a way of life. It's a way of communicating. It's a way of creating community. It's a way of expression. You know, it's so much more than just something that you hit play on and listen to.
So you're originally from Canada.
Yes.
And then you moved to the States. And, you know, so obviously you're not from D.C., but you devoted years of your life to researching go-go music.
I know.
What was the fascination with this music?
So, well, first of all, the first time I heard it was I was coming to Howard University, and I was driving in. I actually came to Howard sight unseen. I just came. My mother and I were driving in. And I was listening to it on the radio, and I was just like, what is that? You know, like, it was so distinctive, and I was just, it was like, what is that music? And so learning about it has just been sort of a journey, so, but it's also been my job. So I was a reporter. I covered youth culture for the Washington Post. At the time that I did, Kip Lornell and Charles Stevenson Jr. released a book called The Beat, Go-Go's Fusion of Funk and Hip Hop. Which was pretty wonderful for, because there really was no other way for outsiders to even get access to know, like, the full rich culture that is go-go. And so with them, by them publishing their book, you know, and then I continued to sort of follow the scene as a reporter because I covered youth culture. So their book came out right as I was starting my job as a youth culture. I wrote for the style section of the Post. And so basically, to me, it was an excuse or a reason or a rationale to say, hey, if you're looking at youth culture in Washington, then you're looking at go-go music. And so that's what I did. And then a couple years later, I went to University of Maryland to do my PhD, and it was actually suggested to me as a topic because people said, you know, whenever you start talking about go-go, you seem to get real excited. Maybe you should try to do something on go-go music. So that's what I ended up doing at the University of Maryland. So that also became my job, right? So I was an ethnographer. I did an ethnography of go-go music. So I continued looking at the scene, published a dissertation. And then the dissertation is what became the book for Duke University Press. So just being, you know, lucky and placed in working in institution, local institutions that claim that they care about local culture, but have some significant gaps when it comes to go-go music and also just the Black community in general. So there are huge gaps, you know, when you're talking about the Washington Post, and you're talking about institutions like the Post and institutions like University of Maryland College Park, you know. So I felt really emboldened, and, you know, I was like, okay, this is important, and that's why I've done it. Plus, I mean, it's just so much fun, you know. I mean, it's such a creative, vibrant, and mostly unique. Like, there really isn't anything quite like it anywhere, actually, you know? So it's like, it's, I just feel like it's a cultural treasure trove and completely underappreciated. And, you know, that gave an opportunity. I saw it as an opportunity for me to, you know, to be able to just fill some gaps and have a lot of fun doing that.
So you talked about how go-go is closely tied into youth culture in the district. And so this music has been labeled as violent or somewhat violent, or attracts violence to it. And it's the same way that they label hip hop. Some, you know, somewhat, this is the music. It makes people go crazy. It makes them violent. And I know that you went to different venues and so forth. And there's one particular person, Slush, who was a Beat Your Feet Kings. He was murdered after leaving one of the go-go venues. I think it was Hot Chops.
Hot Chops in Maryland.
So with that in mind, how do you feel about that label, that go-go music attracts violence, or it incites violence?
I think it's just completely bogus. It's just completely illegitimate. It's just not, like, it's unfortunately that is the prevailing narrative around the music, but it's just not legitimate at all. Like, it has no basis in fact at all. I mean, the music doesn't cause anything, you know? I mean, people might cause things, but music doesn't cause, like, it's not like people are, I mean, it's the whole thing is just, it's really, I just recently did a study of looking at the 80s, and I looked at the music coverage in 87 and 88 in particular. And if you did read the Washington Post, for example, you would think that, you know, you would think that, you know, this is like some trance music, and it's just putting these people into some spell, and, you know, and it's violent all of a sudden. Completely disregarding or not taking into account the larger context that we're operating in. And so that's why I think it's important when you're looking at go-go, you can't just look at the music specifically or what happened at a specific club. You have to look at the whole structural framework that created it. You have to look at the whole history that created it. So what happens in DC in the 80s? We are after white flight, which is after World War II. We are after black middle class flight, you know, which is goes from the 70s to the 80s, right? And so what you have is you have a core, a very delicious chocolate core, but it's also you have a lot of set of circumstances that are really pretty toxic, you know, like you have people, there's unemployment. There's poverty, there's a lack of infrastructure that's going on. And so when you have that, and then you add to that, you throw in, you know, an opportunity for people to make money selling drugs. And so that combination created a very volatile situation on the streets of DC, and people who were here and can remember it being a very, very scary time. And the conga player had absolutely nothing to do with that, you know. So
the jungle music, the
right,
jungle music,
right, right. No, so it's like crazy. Again, I understand that, like, that, yes, there was violence, there were things that were going on during the time, but we really have to divorce it from the music, because the music is like the actual rose that grew out of the concrete, that mess. You know, like, that is actually like the beautiful, innovative, you know, cultural resilience, you know, that you'll find in the city during that time. And so the music is like a very happy story, you know, it's a very positive, uplifting, it's about adversity, it's about innovation, it's about creating something out of nothing, and it's really, it's about community, you know, which is really wonderful, you know, like when you look at a show, it's not like, that's why it's hard to just call it just a music genre. It's not something that you go and you stand up and you watch and you clap politely at the end. You know, it is something that you as an audience, you participate in.
Yeah, you dance.
Yeah.
You talk often about the call and response
that's
in like other forms of African music, where there's an interplay between the audience and the performer. And that's what makes it, go. Like, I can't imagine go-go without the call and response. Like, it'd just be like music, but there's that whole interplay. Like, you have, it's something that you have to experience live. Like, a recording doesn't do it justice. You actually have to be there. And I don't think anyone can appreciate it unless they actually go to a live show.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. And, you know, and that's why it makes it, like, the shout outs and call and response, you know, like, you're acknowledging people, you're acknowledging neighborhoods, you're acknowledging crews, you're acknowledging, you know, groups of people who at the time, you know, if you, again, if you were just judging it based on the Washington Post, you would think that this is a wasteland. You would think that this is a place that is nothing, but actually there's just some really amazing things that are happening. And and more recently, I wrote a piece. I have a column in the Huffington Post that I write, and I wrote a piece about, which actually ended up talking about DC in the 80s, about the black vegan scene in Georgia Avenue, U Street, H Street. That's amazing. Like, so I interviewed Tracy McWhorter, who has a new book called The Ageless Vegan, about her and her mother. She's a DC native too. And she talks about how there were 12 black-owned vegan restaurants in that area from the 80s and the 90s. You know, so again, this comes completely against the narrative of, like, decline, you know, like there was really affirming, you know, life affirming things that were going on in DC in the 80s, and go-go was one of them.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the beginning. Most people attribute go-go's founding with the godfather of soul, Chuck Brown, mm-hmm. who actually 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of Chuck Brown's Soul Searchers, mm-hmm. his band. Mm-hmm. And I know that you got in your interviews, you got a chance to spend some time with him.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Yeah. So Chuck Brown, he is an icon. And actually when my book was published in 2012, people thought that it was about him, mm-hmm. because of the title, because he died literally maybe a month after the book had already gone to press, mm-hmm. you know? And so this is when he passed away. And so I ended up getting a lot of attention, and people were really interested in this sort of world he created. But he is, even just him as a figure, is just incredible, inspirational figure. He was a returned citizen,
mm-hmm.
you know, he had spent time in prison. He was one of these street kids who were like hustling, you know, at the corner of 7th T Street. You know, he mm-hmm. told me stories about that. He was the son of sharecroppers who had moved from North Carolina. So he's also part of the Great Migration, mm-hmm. you know, of many black people came to D.C. as part of that Great Migration after the Civil War. So he was part of that. And he also was somebody who, he said that he created the sound because he told me that he created the sound so that his band can eat,
mm-hmm.
and so his family can eat, and so his band's families can eat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's really what he created. And through this musical style that he ushered in, it really created a whole generation of musicians to pick up their instruments and you know, create this musical culture. But then, of course, there were a lot of other bands that helped build the house mm-hmm. that he created, like Rare Essence is, you know, mm-hmm. a real key band, and, you know, Trouble Funk. There's mm-hmm. some others who are still around and very foundational to go-go. But Chuck is recognized as mm-hmm. the godfather.
The global godfather.
Yeah.
Global citizen.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I was in London in like 2008, and I was in like a record shop. And his album was there. So, and I know that you mentioned briefly that there was a craze for mm-hmm. go-go in London. But before I read that, I always wondered why. I bought the record mm-hmm. just because I was like, hey, Chuck Brown in London. But why?
Do you remember what record it was?
I don't know. It was obviously printed over there.
Okay,
I don't remember.
So it was a local release.
Yeah, it was a local release. But I don't know. I have to go back and look at it to see.
No, I was just curious. Yeah, so it was, you know, the Go-Go's had some flashes, mm-hmm. you know, so there was a moment in London where it was the thing, and there was a moment, you know, there are flashes of where, you know, there are sort of crossover hip-hop Go-Go collaborations that have gotten some sun. Chuck has had a few national hits, mm-hmm. you know, Bustin' Loose was one, and mm-hmm. again, sampled by Nelly. We Need Some Money was another one.
Blow Your Whistle, Eve sampled that.
Right. So they've been sampled. Trouble mm-hmm. Funk has been sampled a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know, Rare Essence also. So, you know, like they had some flashes, mm-hmm. but I would say they're just flashes,
mm-hmm.
you know, like really the heart of it is DC because, and I think it goes back to that idea of community,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the people who are like you who grew up listening to this, grew up understanding what it meant mm-hmm. when you see the people on stage and they start doing their music, what you're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in other contexts, people don't necessarily understand that. Mm-hmm. Like they don't have that whole...
What are these neighborhoods?
Right.
Who is TT?
Right. Or what is... Right.
Who is Boogie?
Right.
Who is Nana on them?
So there is, I think it's sometimes it's hard to translate necessarily, but people have tried. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, bands are open, you know, as always. But I think that the audience, they expect a certain experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give them that experience, then they will come back and they will pay mm-hmm. and it, night after night and generation after generation. And so bands have really catered to their, like, they know who their crowd is
mm-hmm.
and they're loyal to each other. The bands are loyal to the crowds and the crowds are loyal to the bands. And so, you know, while it has created, you know, something really special here, it's not something that very many places outside have been able to appreciate.
Now, speaking of Chuck Brown wanting other, you know, wanting his bandmates or whoever to eat, you mentioned in the book that his drummer actually left to go play with Miles Davis.
Yes, yeah.
In the book, so that's a wonderful story.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of his bands did. You know, and actually, you know, as I said, I went to Howard. One of my husband's friends, who is a musician, we were just randomly in Brooklyn, you know, not too long ago, and, you know, talking to one of him, he was a musician who had started off with Chuck, and, you know, he talked about how demanding he was. He was a very demanding band leader, and, you know, he imposed a certain discipline in his musicians who worked with him, and so it did really become like a school or a workshop for a lot of musicians who ended up, you know, sort of moving on. And, you know, so my and I wish I could remember his name, but he was playing at the time we saw him up in Brooklyn. He was playing for, at some Broadway performance. You know, he's in the orchestra for some Broadway performance. You know, so it's like he's done that for a lot of people.
And also, you spent time with Genghis, a.k.a. Big G of Backyard Band. Yeah. He has another name, the Ghetto Prince.
Ghetto Prince, yep.
And so Backyard Band, the year that I did go to high school, Backyard Band played at our homecoming.
Nice.
So, and I think that was
Backyard. Which high school was that?
This was McKinley Tech.
McKinley, okay.
So I'm going to say it was like 94. Maybe 94 or 95, and they were just like hot on the scene, like just coming out. So talk about, and we were really hyped again because it was Backyard Band. Talk about that experience.
Yes. So he, like, so, you know, we always have to talk about Chuck because he's the godfather, and he is loved and respected, and he deserves it, you know. He's entitled to it. But what I actually spent a lot more time with is, again, the world that he created, you know, and all the people who sort of continued to build the house, the foundation that they built on. And Backyard Band was one of those. And so they represent a newer generation. They had a lot more elements of hip hop. You know, they call themselves, it was called Gangster Go-Go because it was right at the time, 894 at that time was when gangster rap was big. And so it was sort of like, they had a lot of sort of fusion.
Grimy.
A little bit less. Early 80s go-go is very sort of sunny, happy,
jazzy,
and sort of like
funky,
peppy, and real, like almost reggae, like a lot of the songs, you know, like Take Me Out to the Go-Go, and, you know, like they sound like very sort of cheery and kind of light, whereas Backyard Band comes in and they're a lot more driving, a lot more sort of aggressive sound, and definitely more reflecting tastes that are sort of begun to be shaped by hip hop. And Genghis is, or Ralph Glover, he has so many names. People know his government name is Ralph Anwar Glover. He's just a really amazing figure too. Like he's an icon, you know, and he's not that old, but he is definitely an icon in that his personal struggles that he's had, you know, he'd been shot multiple times. You know, so the violence that we're talking about around the 80s and 90s, I mean, he was directly a victim of a lot of those
things. At a show.
At a show he was shot.
Right.
You know, while on stage.
And then he came back the next day and...
That was where he made his legend, right? So do you remember that?
I read it in the book. I don't remember that, but I do remember him being shot. But you mentioning the next day that he performed.
The next day, and he used sanitary napkins, you know, to stop the bleeding. He had crutches. He went on stage. And so that's why I said he's part Fela, he's part Bob Marley. You know, like he's one of these legendary figures. And the other thing that was really notable about that was that when he did get on stage, those who wanted, fans who wanted revenge, he said, leave it alone. He was like, don't do it. You know, and so he was really a voice of peace. He's also very much into activism. You would see him picketing City Hall, you know, lending his voice to various political causes in the city. Just a giant human being and a wonderful spirit, and you know, just a one of these amazing just figures in DC, you know. And, you know, in addition to being, of course, he's band leader, he's still rocking, you know, the shows, but it's a lot of the stuff
his work off outside the concert is also what made him legend. Also, acted in The Wire, mm-hmm. so he played Slim Charles in The Wire, and he's also doing a lot of acting later on as well. But always dedicated to DC, mm-hmm. you know, always loyal to DC, always, you know, trying to bring the city with him, whatever he does.
So when I speak to folks, especially when I was in college, and I would meet people, and I would ask them like if I had friends that were from like California or New York, and I'd say, well, do you like go-go music? And they're usually like, well, what's that?
Yes.
And then so I have to mention The Butt.
Yes.
You know, for them to be like, oh yeah, I like that song, right. but you know, what's the other stuff? Or they either like it or they don't mm-hmm. like it. Mm-hmm. So The Butt.
Yes.
That is the national, international hit. That's the crossover. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that, how that, you know, came, that the song came about.
So The Butt was a song by EU, or Experience Unlimited was what it was called, but EU always. And they did it for Spike Lee's film, 1988 film called School Days. Mm-hmm. And so there was a whole scene that was built around The Butt and the Butt contest. And so what's interesting about that, I remember, I came to Howard in 94, and I remember somebody it coming up in class, like, one of the professors was like, had never, didn't know what go-go was either. And he was like, go-go, what is that? And somebody said, oh, The Butt. But then somebody, a DC native was like, that ain't go-go. Mm-hmm. Don't even call that word out. That's not go-go. But Spike Lee actually wrote that song mm-hmm. with Marcus Miller, you know, who's a New York based musician. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of their interpretation of what go-go is. Mm-hmm. So they threw in a little call and response. Mm-hmm. They had they had some of the musical elements. So there are elements of go-go that I would say it's
go-go. Yeah, it's go-go.
And they still, and definitely when you see EU perform it, which I have mm-hmm. about a million times, right. it's clear that it's go-go. You know, mm-hmm. everybody recognizes it and that's what it is. But it made the top 100 mm-hmm. charts, and you know, so it's one of the easiest things. If you need somebody, if you want to get close, mm-hmm. That's what it is. But it's a studio recording, so you know, this is what we're talking about. Like, go-go is live; mm-hmm. it's an experience, mm-hmm. you know. So it doesn't like for it to be sort of in this studio environment kind of takes away from what it is, mm-hmm. and so people haven't really been able to really translate it very well. So Wale covered a backyard band song. Was it Sexy Lady? Anyway, Pretty Lady. He covered us, and that became a national hit too. Mm-hmm. And that one he did really
That's
good job.
That's TCB, isn't it?
Was it TCB? Well, you know what? Backyard, everybody was covering that was it 2005, 2004, 2005? Anyway, everybody was covering that. But he had Weensy was singing the hook though mm-hmm. on the Wale. Weensy from Backyard Band was singing the hook on the Wale song. So
was it Pretty Girls?
I think Pretty Girls. Okay. That it is. Okay. So that's another example. I think that's a little bit closer. But again, you have different layers. So like the old heads don't consider. So TCB is one of the bounce beat. Mm-hmm. They're the bounce beat generation, and
what is that? What are the different subcategories?
There's
of
so
go-go.
Many. There's gospel go-go. There's there's bounce beat. So bounce beat is the newer generation. Like I say, even after Backyard Band. Mm-hmm. So TCB is there, the standard bearer for that. It's again even more aggressive and mm-hmm. more fast mm-hmm. and more stripped down. And there's even fewer like melodic elements, mm-hmm. you know, it's very aggressive music and people dance really hard. And there's, you know, the whole beat your feet movement that came around. It's a lot of creativity.
Yeah,
and energy.
It's a lot of, their hype. That's definitely after me because I can't keep up.
Like, but see now that for me is not necessarily my generation, mm-hmm. but that's when I got into writing mm-hmm. about going to the show.
I like watching them dance, but
So that's actually when I, you know, that's why I don't like when there's a lot of, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion, especially people who are actually DC natives and actually grew up in it. They can have their opinion and it's legitimate. But I personally, I'm like, no, this is go-go. I don't mm-hmm. know how you can say it's not go-go. You know, it is. It's just a different generation. Mm-hmm. The sound evolves. And with the bounce beat, I often think that it really, and I say this in the book, it really reflects the changes in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, like when Rare Essence and Trouble Funk and all of them are sort of coming through. You have an intact public school system. Mm-hmm. You know, you have marching band in class. You have band class. Right. You know, you have marching bands. You know, you have much more of an infrastructure that's in place to where everybody could sort of pick up, everybody in the neighborhood could kind of pick up their instruments and put a band together. So there's much more of a musical culture. Whereas by the time you're getting to the, you know, mid-2000s, that's being dismantled. Mm-hmm. There isn't really much music being taught at all. Mm-hmm. And that I think that the sound reflects that, mm-hmm. you know, in some cases, you know, like it's you're not getting like those melodies. Mm-hmm. You're not getting that. It's a much more almost nihilistic, like, you know, and even just the sound is much more strapped down. But it's so much fun, though. Mm-hmm. Like they had so there was so much energy there in mm-hmm. the shows. And it's still the core elements, call and response, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, just sort of the idea there's a community, you know, that are fans, you know, that are sort of knitted together with each other as well as the band. You know, it's the, all of those other elements are in place, even though it maybe it doesn't sound the same as it did in the 80s.
Hmm. And speaking of the 80s, mm-hmm. So Go-Go, the Go-Go I remember was like early, that's the early 80s is what I remember. I think Sardines, Junkyard Band was probably one of the first songs that I remember listening to the radio and singing along to. Mm-hmm. But there's also a dance that was spawned from the 80s, the Cabbage Patch,
yeah.
which I didn't know that, you know, we created a national, well, let me say Washingtonians, mm-hmm. Go-Go Music created a national dance craze.
So I think, was it, so I remember this too from the 80s too, because by then I had moved to, I was living in Indiana at the time, and I remember specifically Donnie Simpson doing the Cabbage Patch mm-hmm. On BET, which is what everybody watched, you know, when you were, during that time, everybody watched videos, music videos on BET. I'm not totally sure. I thought that there was a little difference between the DC Cabbage Patch mm-hmm. and the National Cabbage Patch.
Is it?
I don't know.
What's the
One so the like, national one is the one, so you can't see. The national one is the one that we're
more
doing.
Open.
Right. And then
and
that
the local one, I think it was more closed in. Your arms are closed in a little bit more.
Maybe. I don't quote me on that. But yeah, so I do. So yes, but that debt is a DC. But again, BET was based here in DC.
Right, right.
So they're going to be influenced by what is going on in DC music. Although, interestingly, you don't see a lot of videos, go-go mm-hmm. videos on BET.
No, you did.
And they could have. Right. So
wait, work. Well, I do remember that there was I think it was Work the Walls, mm-hmm. Rare Essence, Work the Walls. And that was like the early 90s. And I think that may have been on BET. And I know that people were protesting against it, or there were people who maybe that was the local news. They were talking about it because of some of the scenes in the video.
In the video.
Yeah, it was a little risque.
I'm going to have to look that up. I don't remember
yeah,
that at all.
The Work the Walls, like, mm-hmm. yeah, look that up.
Okay.
You know, I think it was like, they were at a pool, and it was, I think, if I...
The pool parties. Yeah, they were there. The pool parties were big, very controversial in the mm-hmm. 80s, too, because it was a lot of lewd mm-hmm. behavior. And
I think it was a club called Triples that was
yes,
in Temple Hills.
Yeah.
And it was it was a hotel, mm-hmm. they had a club, and then it was a restaurant. Mm-hmm. So if you had go-go, and then what you're going to do after
you had the whole night.
Yeah, you had the whole night. You go home, you go to the hotel and relax after you went to right. go-go because you were tired from dancing.
Right, right. That's right. Resting. Right. But the thing exactly. is that there wasn't, I mean, maybe there might have been a couple or, you know, a handful, but they were not, for as much music was getting produced out of DC, there wasn't as much there wasn't that much. You would think there was a lot more representation on BET. And I personally think, and I talk about this a lot in the book, is just sort of the class elements mm-hmm. in go-go. Like, it's really, there is a separation, mm-hmm. especially in DC. You know, like my friend DJ Renegade, who I quote a lot, he was a big DJ during that time, hip-hop DJ at that time, so he wasn't go-go, but he sort of went to the same places, like Triples. He was performing there in the East Side and all those places. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a distinct divide between mm-hmm. the black middle class and their values. Mm-hmm. So, like, the Howard University, that's not the same as the go-go.
Right.
Like, it's a totally different demographic. And so I think that you know, so it's not like it's universally, you know, widely accepted.
And now, I do remember, and you mentioned this in your book too, going to a go-go at Sidwell Friends, mm-hmm. Going to see Northeast Groovers mm-hmm. at Sidwell Friends, and that's the school that the Obamas sent their mm-hmm. daughters to, and Chelsea Clinton. Yep. Went to that school. So yeah. there was somewhat of a socioeconomic, a mix of
There'll be some, although I would say with those, and so that's definitely a big part of the go-go tradition where you'd have like the black student unions at these white, very white elite private schools that mm-hmm. would host these go-gos. But often they would only let in other people from private schools. You know, like if you could get if you had an ID, you could get in that way. And so they're often limiting. So recently with Georgetown Day School, when they had, there was a big
controversy. And that's where my friend went. Yeah. So I don't know.
You might have gotten your tickets through that. You might have gotten the tickets. But that usually, but that's the ongoing thing. It's mm-hmm. an ongoing debate that they have, because a few years ago at Georgetown Day School, they've always had a go-go, and so they were going to have a go-go, but some of the students, you know, especially in the age of social media, some of the students got real aggressive in the marketing, and so word got out. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was TCB that was performing that time, but word got out, and they had like hundreds of people there that showed up at the mm-hmm. school, and the school was like freaking out. They were like, no, what's going on
here today?
How do we sort of manage this? Because, you know, if the certain bands come, then the people are going to follow.
Right. So, let's see. Now, I just want to mention that you are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio. On today's show, we are talking with Natalie Hopkinson, author of Go Go Live, The Musical Life and Death of a Chocolate City. Something else you talked about in your book was the fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say that the fashion was spawned from the go-go music, or it was something that surrounded the music?
I think I would say, they're closely tied in, you know, because, you know, I think it's sort of analogous, maybe a parallel track to go-go music, where mm-hmm. you have these fashion industries that come on. So right as the urban wear was really big mm-hmm. in, you know, Sean John and Fat Farm mm-hmm. and all those New York-based clothing lines started coming in, they were affiliated with hip-hop music, whereas go-go had its own thing. And mm-hmm. at the time when I really started writing about youth culture, there was still, in the early 2000s, there was still a lot of pressure. Like, you didn't wear Sean John. You wore yes, in the high schools, particularly in PG County, in those high mm-hmm. schools, they were like, that, you're Obama if you wear that. You got to wear the local clothing line, mm-hmm. right? And so you have to, and just like there was a lot of pressure for people, like, to not listen to, like, hip-hop wasn't really the popular thing to mm-hmm. do. I mean, of course, there were people who listened to hip-hop, yeah. right? But it wasn't the
We listened
thing.
To what was on the radio.
Yeah.
Like, if you grew up in New York, there was a whole bunch of other rappers who weren't on the radio, like the underground. But D.C., you listen to whatever was played on the radio, the hip hop and the R&B, but go-go was the party.
Yes. Yes.
Go-go was, you know, where you went on a Friday, Saturday night.
Right.
That was the party.
But with the fashion line, so they were like, and they were really geographic based. So like, mm-hmm. you know, you had All Days, which is in Northeast. Mm-hmm. You had Hobo, which is Southeast. You had We Are One, which was also Northwest. Madness was Uptown.
Shooters
was Northeast.
Yes, Northeast.
Yes. So, you know, when you wore the clothes to the go-go, it sort of would tell you, I think it's Northeast. I think you're right.
Shooters, wasn't that around, like, Potomac Avenue? Didn't they have a store around there?
I think it was Northeast.
I may be wrong.
I don't know either. I'm not. It's been a
Madness
while.
Madness, too.
Madness was definitely up Georgia Avenue.
Now, we had Madness hats. When EU were, mm-hmm. when they did the video, mm-hmm. The thing was the
like
little,
the fisherman hat.
Yeah, the fisherman hat, and you got EU on it.
Yep.
And I remember going up Georgia Avenue, and we all, my brother, sister, and I got the hats.
Nice. Did you get your own name, your nicknames on it? I think that some people would do that.
I know I got EU. Uh-huh. I don't think.
Other people had their nicknames on it.
Yeah.
Well, I heard of some people doing that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a way to
cost
say.
Cost per letter, so.
Right. So, I mean, there was a thing. So it was a way to sort of identify, like, without saying anything, you know, like, okay, I'm representing Northeast or I'm representing Southeast. This is my, you know, these are my spots. So it was kind of that sort of thing. And they were very expensive.
Oh, and Makunu. That was in PD. That, they had a spot in
the mall.
What was that mall in Suitland? I can't think of it now.
Is that Forestville?
Forestville Mall. Yes, yeah.
They. I think they had a couple. So yeah, I actually profiled Makunu. He's in the book too, and all those designs. Makunu is actually one of my favorites. He's a South African designer.
Right, right.
He had grown up in PG County and sort of developed. But he had very creative style. Like, I liked how he had a lot of feminine, more feminine.
Yeah, the clothes were more, like, fitted. Like, because he had men and he had women.
Yes. And so it was sort of like, you know, there were, it wasn't so much the urban wear, like, jogging suit kind of thing. Like, you actually, he had, like, dresses.
It was tailored, yeah.
Yeah, it was sort of tailored. And also, it was sort of wild. Like, he kind of had a wild, you know, like, style. It was just really, like, sort of creative and flamboyant and a lot of fun. But he was definitely part of, like, you saw people, well, when I was covering the scene very heavy, you definitely saw people wearing Makunu. Like, all the people who we were representing, we've just mentioned, like, people would come representing all that, and that was almost the uniform. Like, that's what people wore. Either you wore that or you wore nothing. Like, you just didn't come in, like, representing, you know, like, you didn't come in, you know, there wasn't, again, there wasn't just a lot of Sean John and all of that, you know, so that was what was kind of cool. I mean, D.C., and that's what makes D.C. sort of, like, underappreciated as a cultural center, you know, like, you have, like, I don't know that New Orleans has, can say the same thing, you know, of course New Orleans is wonderful and everything like that, but they don't know that they had the same level of industry and entrepreneurship and Black ownership of all parts of the creative industries as you have in DC. So that's what makes it really unique. So that's another way that I describe GoGo, as a collection of Black owned businesses.
Yeah, it created an economy.
Yes.
So to speak.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And then real quick, because we're running out of time, GoGo Nico. So if you wanted to hear the live music,
yeah,
GoGo Nico, he had a store that you can go to to get the live PA tapes. Talk a little bit about
Nico. Yeah. So GoGo Nico is still one of my best friends in GoGo. My dear, he's like my brother to me. So we've known each other for a long time. He was the PA. He had the PA tapes. So the PA tapes were like the live recordings. Then that developed its own industry where you had people selling the live recordings.
Right.
And so he had operated all over the city. He also sold in like Kent Mill Records. And so he'd sell his music out of the major chains, but then also like the independent chains. So by 2005, when I started doing my PhD research, he had a store set up on 8th Street called Hip Hop
and Go-Go
Factory. And so He right now he has a radio station called Go In Media or GoGoRadio.com. So it's an internet station. It's based out of Iverson Mall.
Okay.
And so they're still broadcasting every day, you know, and, you know, primarily GoGo music every day. And then he still has this massive collection. So he also still supplies music suppliers in the latest GoGo as well. So he's another example of the entrepreneurial space. And, you know, not only is he an entrepreneur, and that's, you know, really important, but he's also, you know, I call him an archivist, you know, because he's got, you know, thousands of live recordings. And this is DC's history. You know, this is life. This will, like, those recordings will help you really understand a dimension of life in DC. So that's why in my book, I just took one classic show at Breeze's Metro Club. So you called it Dino's. It's a club in Northeast.
It was Breezy's, and then it changed to Dino's, I think, when I was in my teens.
Yeah. So this is, of course, now defunct. But there was a classic recording in 1986, Rare Essence. That's just an iconic recording. Actually, if you go on YouTube, you can see it. You can see the recording. And so what I did was I transcribed the whole recording, and I did footnotes, and I explained, okay, who were the such and such honeys? You know, who was this crew? What neighborhood were they talking about? So I did a whole...
Rafael Edmonds.
He had Rafael Edmonds rolled in.
Somebody else.
Tony Lewis.
Yeah,
they came in. Hey, Tony, what's up? So all of that's on the recording. So I have that in my book. And just as a way to give you an example of just how much important things were going on in the go-go and all the things that you could really learn about what's going on, you know. So part of what made it possible to do this research in a journalism program was that I was making an argument that this is the history, this is the news, this is what's happening. If you go to the go-go, that's what you're going to find out. So that live recording from 1986 was just one example of it, but more examples are being created almost every day. Of course, go-go isn't as big as it was. And so, you know, it's not the dominant youth culture movement as it was at the time that I was started doing my research. But it's still...
Do you think it's a correlation between the lack of music in the schools? And
I think that's part of it. I think it's part of, you know, breaking down the neighborhood school system. I think it's gentrification. You know, this is what I'm sort of alluding to with the death of the Chocolate City. You know, where you have gentrification, and you have all these pressures that they're pushing Black people out. It's, I think, a lot of, or and it also could be that, you know, I mean, people, things come in, people go, like, people's tastes are sort of fickle, you know, like, so the fashion industry that we talked about, that really isn't a force anymore. They do still have a lot of these stores that exist, but it's not the dominant, like, okay, if you're going to see somebody a certain age, they're going to be wearing that and they're going to be repping, you know, like, that's the whole cultural thing around it is not as dominant as it once was, but it's still around. So the kind of history that I said that Rare Essence was making in 1986, you still can hear Rare Essence, you know, doing shows and, you know, ecstatic crowds, and you still can see Backyard Band, and you still can see Junkyard, you know, play, Belladonna Band, you know, EU is still, you know, Proper Utensils, you know, like all, they're all, this is a living history that it's still around, and that's what's really inspiring, one of the main things that are very inspiring about the music.
Okay, we are running out of time, but I do have I have this thing that I call Fast Five, where I ask you five questions. You give me first thing that pops into your head.
Okay.
Okay, you ready? Who's your favorite go-go band?
I'm going to say Rare Essence right now, but that's not, I can't say that. I don't know. I can't.
You can't.
Rare Essence is what just popped in my head because I've been thinking about them a lot lately.
So we're going to go with RE.
Yes, we're going to go with them.
Okay. This is the public library. Your favorite book?
My favorite book on go-go?
No, what is your favorite book?
Oh, my favorite book. Oh, man. When the Spirit Catches You, You Fall Down by An Fadiman is one of my favorites of all times. Or The Celestine Prophecy by James Redfield.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which historical figure would you most like to interview?
Harriet
Tubman. Dead or alive.
Harriet Tubman. She's just in my mind right now.
Yeah, she would be awesome. Yeah. I wonder what she would say right now. Favorite Guyanese dish?
Oh, that's easy. Pepper pot.
Okay. And what would you like your legacy to be?
I would like my legacy to be that I helped add to knowledge about culture, about the arts, about history, and you know, I guess that's what I would like to, that's what I want my legacy to be. Also, of course, my kids.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Natalie, for joining me today. This is a very interesting, insightful conversation that we had. And I just want to plug in, like I said at the top of the show, this is Go-Go Month at the DC Public Library. And there's an event that's going to take place Saturday, August 25th. It's a go-go pop-up museum and a panel discussion at the Benning Library. And it's from 1 to 5 p.m. And we invite you to bring go-go items and share your stories about the go-go. This has been an episode of DCPL's All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Have a good day, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.
You just tuned in to DC Public Library Podcast. Listen and subscribe at dclibrary.org/podcast or wherever podcasts are available. Send us your comments at DCPL on Twitter or follow us at DC Public Library on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening.